led him to move from essentially being on that end of politics, if I can put it that way, to being, as it were, the hammer of the unions, given the clip we played earlier on?
Yes. Well, I think he was a sort of rather special kind of trade unionist. It was BALPA, the airline pilots union, and he was, you know, he was a pilot for British Airways for a time, British Overseas Airways, but he saw the way the trade unions worked, and that wasn't one of the major trade unions. But he wanted to make sure that everyone had a chance, and there wasn't a closed shop, and all that kind of thing. And that moved him further off to the right.
Do you think, Michael, just very quickly, you've got about 5 seconds, do you think he would survive 10 minutes in politics today?
I wish he would, because every time you were doing an interview, you'd know you'd get a great quote.
Okay. That's it from us today. Tim Montgomery's here on Monday at 1 o'clock. But next up on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Trevor. 2 o'clock, it is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four.
What has the air traffic control outage left you feeling about your summer holidays and travelling to them? Why are fewer young people learning languages? Are Katy Perry and Justin Trudeau an item? How long do you like your songs to be? And after 3:30, the screenwriter Daisy Goodwin.
And here's the news at two, Nick Ellaby.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A 76-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of administering poison at a summer camp, which led to 8 children being taken to hospital. Leicestershire police received reports of children feeling unwell at a summer camp in Staten on Monday. The suspect was arrested at the camp. Times Radio spoke to crime and police commentator Danny Shaw.
He's being held under the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act on suspicion of administering poison or a noxious thing with intent to injure, aggrieve or annoy. He is still in custody at this time. So police investigation ongoing, but all the children, it seems, are OK, which is good.
Meanwhile, the Independent Office for Police Conduct is now investigating Leicestershire Police's handling of the incident, looking into what caused a delay in their response. The Royal College of Nursing is threatening strike action over nurses' pay as they vote to reject the government's offer of a 3.6% rise. The nursing union says that's not enough to turn the tide for what they feel is an undervalued profession. 91% of nurses voted to reject the deal in a record turnout of 56%. The Department of Health and Social Care says it's disappointing RCN members are dissatisfied after receiving 2 above-inflation pay rises from this government. The Transport Secretary says there's no evidence malign activity was responsible for yesterday's outage of air traffic control systems. After a call with the head of National Air Traffic Service, Heidi Alexander's called it an isolated incident. The Times transport and travel correspondent Ben Clatworthy says we still don't know what caused the glitch.
What we do know, though, is that it affected the system that basically displayed the information on the controller's screen. So that when you hear that, becomes very clear why they need to take drastic action in that moment in order to restore that full picture of what's the activity that's happening at the time.
NATS has apologised after thousands of passengers suffered extensive travel disruption during one of the busiest times of the year. A report warned the healthcare system failed to listen to the family of a boy who died from sepsis despite being sent home from hospital 8 days earlier with antibiotics. Yusuf Nazir from Rotherham was just 5 years old. His relatives now want an inquest. Just shy of 900 people arrived in the UK on 13 small boats yesterday, taking the total number of migrants crossing the Channel this year to more than 25,000. It's the earliest that figure has been reached so far, and numbers are up 51% on this point last year. Ministers insist they're cracking down on people smuggling gangs. And half of Americans think the economy is getting worse under President Trump. An exclusive YouGov poll for The Times also shows only 13% of Americans are feeling any financial benefit since Donald Trump promised to bring prices down immediately and make America wealthy again. 1,470 adults in the US were polled across July 18th to 21st to gauge views of Trump's second term as it approaches its 200th day next week. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
A very good afternoon to you. So whenever we arrive in the studio, it is a hot seat changeover from the previous programme. Very, very warm today. But also it means that we can see all of the messages that have come in across the day so far to Times Radio. And sometimes they're just funny. There's one that just says, what planet is your interviewee on? We're going to talk about flight chaos. Although there is no suggestion that the fire in a substation and this outage of air traffic control are the fault of bad actors, yesterday's outage may well have made you feel a little bit wobbly about relying on your time of departure at any major airport in the UK. This is a huge weekend for travel. Happy holidays if you're trying to get to them. We're going to assess the true impact in a couple of moments' time. We'll start with nurses. 91% of RCM members don't think that the 3.6 pay increase keep up has been enough. What a pickle our health service is in. Also today, in the next 2 hours, gone are the days of the 2-minute 30 pop treat. Longer songs are making a comeback. Can it be true, and these are separate stories, that Katy Perry is dating Justin Trudeau? We're going to roar through that rumour. Tuition fees are going up, tough on students of today, but also not enough to guarantee the future of universities of tomorrow. We will talk about that pickle too. And after 3:30,
we've got the screenwriter, journalist Daisy Goodwin. She has written a play called By Royal Appointment. It is about the late Queen, Elizabeth II, her wardrobe, her clothes, who made them, what message she was trying to convey through her outfits, and a woman who became hugely significant in her life, a Scouser by birth called Angela Kelly, Docker's daughter, who met the Queen at the British Embassy in Berlin and in later life just became incredibly close to her. She designed her clothes and took care of her to a degree. And was then somewhat, rather brutally, some might say, frozen out by the royals when the Queen died. So I think there's probably Angela Kelly is still very much around. That's an interview everybody would like, but nobody will ever get, I suspect. But Daisy Goodwin knows much more about this story, and she's going to talk to us after 3:30 this afternoon.
Why was she frozen out? Was it a natural kind of, well, the woman who employed you is no longer with us, therefore there isn't a place for you here?
I think, and Daisy will know more about this, Angela Kelly had been given to expect that she would be able to carry on living in her so-called grace and favour property on a royal estate. And then it was made very clear that, in fact, she wasn't going to be welcome. So the king bought her another property elsewhere in the country. That's where she now lives.
OK, so not all bad.
No, I don't think it's necessarily how she thought life would pan out.
No, fair enough.
But anyway, Daisy will know, and let's hope she does, know much more than I do about this interesting story, and we'll hear the truth, or certainly what Daisy knows about what really went on, a little bit later.
I'd love a dresser, but unfortunately it wouldn't really be a full-time job. It'd be about 4.5 minutes in the morning. And even less
four
in the
and
evening.
A half minutes. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's me. Jay Moore-Kerrins is in at 3:45, intellectual saucepot of Times Radio. She's coming in to discuss what's in the Saturday Times magazine. Most read stories on the website so far today.
Number three, glitch in UK radar system, shut down air traffic control screens. Air traffic control systems failed because of a radar system software glitch. This happened yesterday afternoon. This is what the Times has been told about this. There'll be more on that shortly. At number two, man convicted of attacking police in Manchester Airport brawl. A man has been found guilty of attacking police officers in a fight at Manchester Airport, a brawl that went viral last summer. And the most read piece on the Times website, well, this will appeal to Fee. She is a classicist. It's Christopher Nolan's new film, selling out already. It doesn't come out for a year. It comes out in the July of 2026. But people cannot wait to get their hands on tickets for The Odyssey, directed by Christopher Nolan. He's obviously a great director. It's quite a story. Zendaya's in the film, Tom Holland and Matt Damon. Now, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, nurses are threatening to take industrial action as they vote overwhelmingly to reject the government's pay offer of 3.6%. More than 170,000 nurses participated in the ballot for a turnout of 56%, with 91% voting to reject the pay deal. So of those who turned up for the vote overwhelmingly, it was a vote against. Let's discuss all of this with Poppy Karonka, Times Health correspondent. Right, where does this take us to then?
Well, for now, we're not entirely sure. The Royal College of Nursing, the Nurses Union, has asked the government to take the summer to essentially come up with a new proposal, a new pay deal. If they're not able to do that, then the nurses have said that they would essentially raise a more formal pay dispute, and then they might be looking at industrial action. They would need to do another ballot before that industrial action, but it's definitely seems like it's on the table now.
Should anybody be raising eyebrows about what is a low turnout, 56%? I mean, it's only just above half.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because the RCN have said that this is a record turnout for them. So it's actually the most number of nurses that have ever voted in a pay deal for the RCN.
Is it really?
Yeah. Okay. So it does seem like it's not that many, but actually it is for them. It shows a big strength of feeling compared to what they usually have.
So the health secretary is then fighting off strikes on all sides.
Every side.
Yes. So, I mean, if there was a notion that even if a pay award to the doctors wasn't going to be on the table, some change in their conditions might have been. We don't know where that is now and where Streeting's head. Might a similar thing avert strike action for the nurses?
I mean, perhaps. In their release that they sent out about the results of this ballot, they did say that there was a number of things that they were unhappy about. A number of those was a huge number of vacancies in nursing, just not enough people for jobs. Another one was the actual pay scale itself and how it's set up. So nurses go on a band pay scale. It means that pay increases are quite regulated and quite structured, but it does mean that there's quite a low ceiling as to what you can earn. So those things might help. They've also said that they're undervalued, that their career progression is limited. I mean, any of those kind of things might help. But I do think it's probably pay that is the main issue.
And where do you think public opinion and public support will be on this? It's interesting that you've just used the term undervalued. That connection that we want to have with nurses almost has a kind of sanctity about it. But in this instance, we know that the doctors have faced quite a public backlash for their pay demands. Would it be the same for nurses?
I mean, it sort of remains to be seen as to where we'll find out the reaction today. I think the backlash to the junior doctors striking was a lot to do with the fact that they got quite a large pay rise the year before. Nurses haven't really had that ever. And I think, you know, I think it's quite a sympathetic case. Whether, you know, it's hard to say because they haven't actually said that they'll strike yet. Yeah. You know, if it does come to be and, you know, the conditions and the parameters of that strike, it might mean that the public does turn against them. It's sort of hard to see that happening with nurses as a profession, I think.
Well, Poppy, one thing is for certain. We will talk again about this, won't we?
I'm sure we will.
Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. The Times' health correspondent, Poppy Karonka.
Just the doctor strike is now over, isn't it?
That's it ended at 7 a.m. on Wednesday.
Right. Yeah, okay.
We're going to find out the impact of that, hopefully, in the next few days.
Well, I was going to ask about that. So, I mean, did it pass, as far as we know, without major incident?
We're sort of finding out numbers now, but it seems like a lot less appointments, a lot less were cancelled, a lot less disruption than last time. We're waiting for official numbers, but hospitals did try and carry on as usual this time. So a lot less disruption, it seems, than before.
Thank you very much. It is Times Radio. It's nearly 13 minutes past two. Well, the Transport Secretary says there's no evidence that malign activity was in any way responsible for yesterday's air traffic control outage. Although looking at your WhatsApp messages, this afternoon, at least one of you thinks that is just not true. 150 flight cancellations meant that passengers suffered extensive travel disruption during, of course, what is one of the busiest times of the year. Ben Platworthy is Times transport correspondent. So, Ben, we do have a message here from a listener who says, well, look, you know, we know quite well who could be responsible for what happened yesterday. Is it absolutely definite that this wasn't in any way the responsibility of another state?
Good afternoon. Certainly, the messaging coming out of NATS, the UK air traffic controller, and also the government is that this was a simple computer failure. Now, the word simple is obviously an understatement here, because actually what happened was the system went down for 20 minutes, by which point they were able to get a backup system running. What we're told, and this was from the readout from the conversation this morning between Heidi Alexander, the Transport Secretary, and Martin Rolfe, the boss of NATS, is that the software that runs the that takes the information and puts it on the air traffic controller's screens is what went down. Now, obviously, that is a crucial piece of national infrastructure. They therefore made the decision immediately to put the ground stop on flights, which is why the delays happened at airports, while they switched over to the backup system. And it is that backup system that is still being used now while they try and find out the exact root cause of it. But they are insistent that it is not a cyber attack and that it was very much a issue with the computer system.
And it didn't actually last that long, but the impact has been colossal and so many people inconvenienced, and actually worse than that.
What's with aviation, everything is highly regulated in terms of the hours that crew and pilots can work, but also it runs like clockwork. Everyone has slots. It's not just a slot at a UK airport. You have a slot at your arrival airport as well. And as soon as those things start getting missed, even in times of weather and so on, I'm sure people have sat on planes where the pilot comes on and says, "I'm terribly sorry, it's bad news. We're going to miss our slot and we could be sitting here for 2 hours. We'll try and ask air traffic control for an earlier slot." And that's what happens. As soon as you get something as big as this, even for 20 minutes, there is just no slack in the system. And people miss their departure slots, but also their arrival slots at other airports. And what we saw yesterday was it was mid-afternoon. So the people who really felt the brunt of it were A, those sitting on the tarmac in the UK, but also passengers waiting to come home, some of whom's flights were cancelled because by the time the aircraft got, what in airline terms they say, down route, i.e. abroad, it was the crew had got out of hours or they would miss their curfew to come back into the UK airports.
So will they get compensation?
There's no compensation because the issue was outside of the airline's control. However, and this is useful for people that were affected. If you should have had your food and drink, non-alcoholic drinks, covered. If you didn't and you were delayed for more than 2 hours, keep the receipts and put them into the airline. If you were stranded overnight and you ended up booking a hotel that wasn't paid for by the airline as well, you can claim that back. Just put the full receipt into the airline.
Ben, I know that we're not going to join the dots in a sinister way between this and the fire that caused the outage at Heathrow, but undoubtedly these two incidents do make us look a little bit shaky in terms of our airport infrastructure, just at a time at which the Chancellor wants to be able to sell us on the international stage as the hub for growth. So does this do lasting damage on this front? Is it a wake-up call? If so, will it be answered?
I think the issues with NATS, and, you know, people say, well, you'll never have something that's perfect. Well, critical national infrastructure should be near perfect. And when it's not perfect, people need to examine why it's not perfect. It's the same with Heathrow. I was astounded when the report into the Heathrow fire came out, and it turned out that the energy operators didn't even know when they're supplying critical national infrastructure. And this sort of what could be seen as amateurism or lack of preparedness is really important. And we know that, you look back to the pandemic, it was sort of, there was whole issues around preparedness. And that's something that in this country we seem to have lost a grip on, is being prepared for when the worst happens. And actually, these two instances, you say, when in isolation, are two completely separate issues, although they both had exactly the same as the WhatsApp message saying, is it an external state? It wasn't. But ultimately make us look like we're just not really prepared for the risks. And also that you can't guarantee that technology is perfect, but there should be quicker backups even than 20 minutes for a system like air traffic control.
And I think those of us who use air travel not that frequently, so we're always a little bit worried about it, if I'm honest. I am talking about myself. The idea that there could be any problem with air traffic control is actually terrifying, Ben, in honesty.
Well, that's why the big message coming out of NATS is that, look, as soon as they knew the system had gone down, which was immediate, they put the ground stop, which prevents planes from taking off, into force immediately to maintain safety. And safety is always, in aviation, spouted as the number one priority. You'll find it's the same whenever airport security is discussed. It all comes down to safety. And they will say that the best thing to do is to disrupt people or cancel flights if it keeps them safe. We look at the incident in 2023 on the bank holiday weekend when 2,500 flights were cancelled, 700,000 passengers disrupted. In that instance, what happened was a rogue flight plan upset the primary system. It shut down. The backup system received the same flight plan. It should have responded slightly different. It didn't, and it shut down. Now, NATS will say, look, it's not ideal, but actually the fail-safes worked, the system shut down, and that is the most important thing. And in many ways, when it comes to aviation, inconvenience will always be the lesser of two evils in terms of, well, the worst that could happen. And in this sense, in a way, the same thing is what has been applied. It's let's stop, let's hold everything, let's get the backup system and know that it's completely safe. And for people who, as you say, are nervous about it, I would personally rather that happened than ever finding out through some strange report that we didn't know was coming that there was a blackout where no one saw the screens.
Thank you. I think that's reassuring. I do hope that seagull doesn't get hold of your chips. Where are you?
I'm actually walking back to our beautiful office in central London, but I've just been meeting someone.
Oh,
do you want to tell us more? Sounds intriguing.
I thought you were on some windswept hillside. Thank you very much.
It's the very enigmatic Ben.
Tell you what,
I've been meeting someone
on manoeuvres. Ben Clatworthy, Times transport correspondent. We are very grateful to him for his contribution.
And good luck with your travel this weekend. Coming up, Don't Bore Us, Get to the Chorus. Songs are getting longer. We'll find out why. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio, coming up to 20 minutes past two.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
So what is really happening? Or rather, in many, many cases, not happening. And why?
Intelligent analysis.
I will get you the full picture of this crisis. And I guess we can use that overused term given these facts.
And diverse opinion.
It is perfectly reasonable to object strongly to what happened. And joining that chorus is surely covered by the right to free speech.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgetto? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, did you know that songs are getting longer? You might be surprised by that, with everybody just, I don't know, devouring TikTok and with apparently ever-shortening attention spans. The average length of a hit single in the first 6 months of this year has risen to almost 3.5 minutes. Let's talk to music journalist Helen Brown. Helen, first of all, are you surprised by this?
I mean, to be honest, it's not a massive change. What we're looking at is a shift in the length of songs between 2021 to 2025 of 12 seconds. They've got 12 seconds longer in the past 4 years.
Yeah.
And that's the average hit song. So yeah.
Don't knock the story, Helen. This is a very, very important subject.
It's huge, sorry.
Yeah. I don't.
It's 12-inch news.
Thank you. In the 50s and 60s, songs were super snappy, weren't they? I mean, there were tracks that were 2 minutes long, some cases even less.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some of that's about saving money on the vinyl. That's the jukebox machines turning over the income for cafe earners. I mean, there's a lot of practical reasons behind these things. You look at the rise of those really long, sprawling prog rock songs in the 70s. You know, that's vinyl's big stoners don't want to get up. You know, there's a lot of practical reasons behind these things.
I am so glad that you have now explained why those really short songs were there. It was to help people in cafes with jukeboxes so they could earn more money. Of course it was.
That's my theorising. But yeah, well, I grew up with a big stack of jukebox records that my mum had bought, and they were really tiny.
Yeah.
With a big hole cut out of the centre.
I had a really short song by the Swinging Blue Jeans, and for the life of me, I wish I could remember what that title was. Let's see if we can go back in time and find out what that was. Can you tell us, and I want you to introduce it for us, please, Helen, tell us about your favourite long song. What is it?
Well, it's not a super long song. The hit songs are normally around 3 minutes, but my favourite sort of mid-length song is Sufjan Stevens' Should Have Known Better, and I think it explains why some songs need to be longer. So you're Bohemian Rhapsodies, your American Pies need to tell a story. But Sufjan Stevens' Should Have Known Better, what it does is it starts with a man in a very depressed state, and it sort of starts with gentle guitar picking. And then the synthesizer comes in and lifts it. And as this very normal man looks for very normal reasons for being happy, there's a simple line: my brother had a daughter, the neighbor's greeting, a cantilever bridge. He just finds small things to make him happy, and the synth creeps in. And that happens after the average length of a hit song. That happens at the 3.3-minute mark. Suddenly his whole mood shifts, and it's always magical for me. I love that song.
Oh, let's hear a bit of that. And Helen, this song, which sounds rather lovely, got you into trouble.
No, this is not the song that got me into trouble. The song that got me into trouble was Fool Skull by the Stone Roses. That is a 9-minute single. My friend had a breakup, and this was his absolute favourite song. So we put it on back to back 10 times in a bar when I was at university, and we were thrown out. It's the only time I've ever been banned, thrown out of a bar and banned from coming back, was because we had given those people 100 minutes of basically the same guitar riff, because we just wanted to dance. We wanted to dance this man's ex out of his system.
Yeah, well, you were helping a mate. I think that's rather lovely. Some songs are absurdly long. Donna Summer, this is I Feel Love, I think, by Donna Summer.
No, this isn't.
This isn't, but it's this is Fool's Gold, right?
Well, oh, yeah.
Here we are.
Just picture me being thrown out of the bar, baggy jeans, yeah.
Yeah, I can picture that. What were you eating, or was food not that important to you in those days?
It was the late 90s. It was cider and blackcurrant. I think we probably took the glasses with us. Yeah, it was those years.
Yeah, you didn't need carbs. You had cider and blackcurrant, the world's most revolting drink.
It was awful. Why? What were we thinking?
Well, I don't know. You're a lot younger than me, so I haven't thought about it. Can we talk about Donna Summer's I Feel Love? I think we can get a bit of that going. Now, Donna could actually really Well, she could lose all her senses, couldn't she, and actually go a little bit off-piste for you, couldn't she? This, you'd go on for 17 minutes.
Well, this does go on for a very long time, but I do think, Helen, it's one of those songs that simply wouldn't have worked if it was 2 minutes 30. The whole point of it is that it just it manages, through its beat and its length, to take you to a different place, shall we say.
It's transcendent, isn't it? That's the whole point. And you've got these nerds behind it. You've got Giorgio Moroder kind of coming up with this new programming. He's like a giddy, happy nerd, you know, sort of literally ticking all the kind of meditative boxes in the background. And then Donna Summer had just met the man she was going to marry. She was in love. She had phoned her astrologer, who had told her that she should stop seeing the man she was dating because the stars had aligned and she should definitely get together with Bruce, the man she would go on to spend the rest of her life with. So she literally got off the phone from the astrologer, went into the studio, and having made this decision to, you know, have the love affair of her life, sang that. And one take.
You are certain they asked?
One take.
Are they
one
still
take.
Together, wow. Helen? Are you certain about that?
She died, but yes, they were together until she died.
Gosh, Donna Summer has died. How did I miss that?
No, have I gone mad?
I'm almost certain it's me. It won't be you. unbelievably, we've managed to find the Swinging Blue Jeans. We honestly have. No, they couldn't sit still. That was 1 minute and 47
Thank
seconds.
Thank God.
I don't know why I loved it, but it was a good song. And Fee has got news from the other side.
Donna Summer left us a long time ago on the 17th of May 2012.
Grief.
God, I'm glad I didn't accidentally kill her off then. I had an awful moment of panic.
No, Helen, it's never you.
No, she was 63 years old.
Oh, that's very sad, isn't it?
It is, yeah. She definitely went too soon, didn't she?
Yeah, she really did.
The shortest song of all time is late 80s as well. So this is way before TikTok has any impact on anything. And it was a joke by the British grimecore band Napalm Death. And it was called You Suffer. And it lasts 1.3 seconds. And they just go, you suffer, but why? Short and sweet.
Well, you've been an absolute godsend this afternoon. Cheered everybody up. Thank you very much, Helen. Yes, thank you.
I get a dance to that one now.
Yeah, should we let ourselves go? Should we hear the end?
Yeah. Well, now you shake it to the left, you shake it to the right, you do the hippie shake shake with all your might, oh baby. Yeah, come on, shake. Heart in the band. Ooh, the hippie, hippie shake. Ooh, the hippie, hippie shake. Ooh, the hippie, hippie shake.
Oh, go away.
Fabulous. I used to love that.
Oh, thank God that's over. Right, it is 2:30. Katy Perry and Justin Trudeau are rumoured to be dating. More on that one after the news with Nick Ellerby.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. A 76-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of administering poison at a summer camp, which led to 8 children being taken to hospital. Times Radio spoke to crime and police commentator Danny Shaw after Leicestershire police were contacted about children feeling unwell at a summer camp in Statham on Monday.
The report, they say, was made by a third party. They then sent officers along with paramedics, ambulance staff to safeguard the children. Following an initial assessment, the police said 8 children were taken to hospital as a precaution. The good news is that all have since been discharged.
The suspect was arrested at the camp and is still in custody. Nurses in England could soon vote on whether or not to strike after rejecting a pay deal from the government of 3.6%. The Department of Health says nurses have been offered 2 increases above inflation. The Transport Secretary says there's no evidence malign activity was responsible for yesterday's outage of air traffic control systems. 150 flights were cancelled due to what's being described as an IT glitch. More than 25,000 migrants have crossed the English Channel so far this year, a milestone hit earlier than last year. 13 boats arrived yesterday alone, carrying 898 people. And half of Americans think the economy is getting worse under President Trump. An exclusive YouGov poll for The Times also shows only 13% of Americans are feeling any financial benefit since Donald Trump promised to bring down prices. You can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio.
To whoever finds this letter, my car broke down. There is nothing nearby. And I've already eaten my meal deal sandwich. Please tell my wife that I love her and that she was right. This jacket isn't waterproof. Signed, Daniel S. Oh, actually, scrap that. Green flag's just arrived. Blimey, less than an hour.
Local rescue, nationwide. Nothing beats near. Green flag.
On average, we get to breakdowns in under an hour based on app and phone callouts combined between July 24 and June 25.
Today's the day. The day that Jim feels he can't carry on. Unable to see beyond his problems. His pain unbearable. So thankfully today, he reached out to us. Samaritans. And that could save Jim's life. Leave a gift in your will to Samaritans and support people who are struggling to carry on. Help us save lives today, tomorrow, always. To find out how, search Samaritan's Wills.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, a listener, excuse me, that's terrible, isn't it, to be clearing my throat as soon as the microphone goes up.
Standards.
Well, I've got a very foolish snack in the studio with me today. I've got some nuts, and I don't think that really works at all. They're roasted and salted, and it just means that they're stuck in the back of my throat.
They're from a very high-grade supermarket.
Well, they are, but they're still stuck in the back of my throat, unfortunately. My
apologies. But if you're going to go on one of their nuts.
OK. HQ, nothing to apologise for, or is it HO, one of our listeners, because you texted in about that theory that maybe something was really awry after the air traffic control system went down yesterday. And after listening to our interview with Ben Clatworthy, he says, thank you, or you might be a she. Not sure I believe the PR, but I'm in danger of sounding like some conspiracy theorist. So I'll take my tinfoil hat off and have a nice cup of tea and listen to lovely Times Radio, keeping calm and carrying on. Well, there's nothing to apologise for, because I think now the awful truth, Jane, is that when something does go wrong with our infrastructure, we all immediately think, are we being attacked by a nation state that doesn't have our best interests at heart? And there are still so many people who believe that in other countries where their infrastructure has been very badly affected, that's exactly what happened, but their governments simply don't want to tell them the truth about what happened because it would be so frightening. So I think we're all caught in that loop, and there's absolutely nothing to apologise for. If you've got a picture of you in your tinfoil hat, do send that in. University tuition fees rise for the first time in 8 years tomorrow. Students starting the new academic term will now pay £9,525 for their education, but universities say the increase is nowhere near enough, with 40% of them now running a deficit. Well, Joanna Burton is the head of higher education policy for the Russell Group, a collection of 24 of the UK's highest achieving universities. Joanna, what does this fee increase mean for your members?
Hi, thanks very much for having me. So, after nearly a decade of freezes in the tuition fees, the increase that we're seeing for this new academic year is a real signal that this government is recognising the financial pressures that are facing universities. This fee increase won't solve everything when it comes to the financial pressures, but it will help to maintain teaching quality and a great student experience for students. It's really important, though, to remember that students themselves will not be paying more as a result of this fee increase upfront. Tuition fees are paid directly to the universities from the government, and the repayment terms, the repayment structures will remain the same for students.
OK, but it does mean that it goes on to the student loan, doesn't it?
It will. So it will mean that the longer term debt that they come away with will increase, and that will be paid back as a proportion of their future earnings. But where students really are feeling the squeeze is on the day-to-day living costs. So with rising costs of accommodation, food and all of the daily essentials, this is really where more needs to be done to support students with money in their pockets.
Sure. If we talk about what's going into the university coffers, though, can you explain some of the quite dire circumstances that some universities are finding themselves in?
Yes, absolutely. So you mentioned already that the fee has been frozen. So that was £9,000 in 2012, rising to 9,250 in 2016. What that means with the impact of inflation is that the real terms value of the fee is only worth today £6,700 in real terms to universities. So that's only two thirds of the sticker price. That is compounded with a reduction in the real terms value of the teaching grant that's paid from the government to universities, and increasingly universities covering more of the costs of research. All of those things together with inflation and rising costs means that universities are facing increasing financial challenges.
Right, so you started off the interview saying that the government was recognising that there were problems for universities in making this increase, but actually, given everything you've just told us, they're not. I mean, they're not doing enough to really change the deficit for some universities. And presumably the reason why they're not was in your second answer, which is you don't want to load it onto the students, but that is the only method. It was created mm-hmm. by a previous government, and that is the method available to universities for funding.
Absolutely. So it is a small step, and as I said, it will not. It's not enough to fix the problems, the financial challenges that are facing universities. The new government has taken this step to recognise the problems, but they're also looking at longer term reform to the higher education system. We're expecting a white paper later in the year which will set out the government's proposals on how to put the university system on a more long-term financial sustainable footing. And that's what we in the Russell Group and others in the sector want to work with the government to make sure that the funding system is sustainable for future generations of students.
Does it also mean that your universities within the Russell Group will have to take even more foreign students, because that is a method of funding available to them where they have more of a say in what gets paid?
It is correct that tuition fees for international students are uncapped, and there's still a strong demand for UK higher education from overseas students. Their tuition fees do cross-subsidise into funding the costs of teaching home undergraduates and for funding the vital research that universities do as well. So by taking on more international students, universities are actually able to expand the offer that they can have and the places available for home students.
But it does cause consternation, doesn't it, to home students, the idea that actually you've worked very, very hard to get into one of these prestigious universities. The only reason why you haven't got a place is because a student from a different country has got that place because the university can't balance the books. Ouch.
Ouch indeed. I mean, it is competitive to get into Roscoe universities. Demand is very strong, and it is true that it's competitive. It's not the case, though, I wouldn't say, that international students are taking places away from home students. It's the funding model that exists right now, which means that their fees can actually grow provision for home students. However, it is a financial model that is not sustainable, that we can't continue in this way. And so we're looking to government to make those changes to put it on that more stable footing.
Do you think in 10 years' time, Joanna, actually universities are just going to have to look very, very different indeed? And one of the big things will be just not expecting so many kids to go to university.
Yeah, these are big questions, and it's still a huge decision to go to university. And you can understand with rising costs and the graduate labour market the way it is now, those are big decisions. As I said, there is still high demand for university, and it is completely transformative experience. There's evidence to show that it boosts your employability and sort of earnings potential in the future, as well as all the other benefits that it does bring. How the system looks in 10 years' time, I think that's going to have to be a function of the funding model that is put in place. It's not sustainable as it exists right now.
And do you think any of your universities would actually go bust in those 10 years?
Difficult to say. I mean, the Office for Students has, which is the regulator of the higher education sector, has said that around 40% of universities are showing deficits at the moment. Russell Group universities are not immune to the financial pressures that exist. I think we want to make sure that we work to avoid universities going bust. Universities have to play their part in that as well. So there's a lot of work going on in the sector to realise transformation and efficiencies, to sort of save money where they can. It may make the shape of university look different, but efficiencies alone are not going to be big enough to solve these wider systemic problems.
And do you think that the Russell Group will stand the test of time? I mean, it's quite a strange thing, I think, for people outside of the UK, outside of an academic institution, who don't have kids who want to go to universities, from the kind of schools that want them to go to Russell Group universities, just go, what? What is this thing? What is this strange cabal of universities who just keep telling us that they're better than everybody else? You describe yourself as a collection of 24 of the UK's highest achieving universities. But what does that even mean? Is that employability? Is that going out into the workplace, not having a breakdown 4 years later? Is that having had a great time at university? What is it?
So it's a great question. So Russell Group universities are all large and research intensive universities. So they really power the research and development that really boosts the UK economy. They also offer really high class, world class teaching and learning experience for students. 80% of graduates from Russell Group universities go on to high skilled jobs 15 months after they graduate. The universities not only offer education, but also much broader in terms of pastoral support and societies and all of the things that university life has to offer. Russell Group universities are, and actually a lot of universities in the UK outside the Russell Group are world renowned for their quality of their research and their teaching. You just need to look at the world rankings to see, we are in a really globally competitive market, and the UK, really should rightly be proud of its higher education offering. But it is, as we have been discussing, facing these enormous financial pressures, and the first thing that we would want to see is for students themselves to look again at the maintenance support that's on offer for them, so that they can make the most of their time at university. We're seeing increasingly students having to work alongside their studies, and that's obviously taking precious time away from getting the most out of their study.
I think you did brilliantly in that answer, Joanna. Thank you very much indeed for defending the Russell Group. Joanna Burton is the head of higher education policy for the Russell Group. You went to a Russell Group university, Jane, didn't you? No, but did it matter to you that it was one? I don't think I did.
I'd never heard of it when I went.
Okay.
Right. So, and I mean, as you said to Joanna, I think most people don't really know. What I will say is that anybody who went to Oxford and Cambridge will tell you about it within the first nanosecond of your meeting. Has that been your experience, Joanna? Perhaps you went yourself.
I attended a Russell Group university, not one of the two that you mentioned.
Okay, right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Times Radio. And next, forget California girls. What about Canadian boys? Yes, Katy Perry is rumoured to be dating geopolitical hottie Justin Trudeau. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio, 2:45.
Alexis Conran on Times Radio with Blacklane, the global chauffeur service. Embark on a luxury journey with Alexis every weekend as he unpacks the weekly news agenda and investigates the issues behind the headlines. Plus, don't miss Arriving in Style, your expert guide to all the best events this summer, whether you're staying local or travelling further afield. Alexis Conran, every Saturday and Sunday afternoon from 1 on Times Radio with Blacklane, the global chauffeur service. Arrive better with Blacklane. Download the app to book now.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
I've been asked by Shredded Wheat to read out their ingredients list. Drum roll. Whole grain wheat. No, that's it. A single ingredient, high fibre cereal. Shredded Wheat. It simply does it. I'm telling you, that's it. Applies to Shredded Wheat Bite Size and Big Biscuit only.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Billing Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Baby, you're a firework. Come on, let your colours burst.
You're a pyrotechnic, political hunk. Would that be fair? I mean, there's not a lot of competition for leading geopolitical hottie, is there really? And I think while...
What are you saying?
Well, no, whilst Justin Trudeau was in office, and I'm not talking about his politics here, whenever he appeared at a G8 or G7 or whatever it might be, you did think, well, yeah, he cuts an impressive figure. Am I right?
Well, I think so. I think the thing that distinguishes him at the moment is he's one of the few who's single.
Well, he's not in office, so he's got time on his hands. Now, the former Canadian Prime Minister has been seen on a dinner date with Katy Perry, who, you might recall, has had quite the time lately. She did go on that Blue Origin flight into space.
I feel super connected to love. So connected to love. I think this experience has shown me you never know how much love is inside of you, like how much love you have to give.
Yes, Charlotte Oliver is features writer for The Sun. Charlotte, now I imagine you're not as cynical as I am, and you really do believe.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Okay, you really do believe that there might be something going on here. Tell us what all these rumours, what are they based on?
There's definitely something going on here. We'll give them that. But cynicism aside, Katie and Justin were spotted on Monday enjoying a not so clandestine dinner date in Montreal. She's in Canada for the Canadian leg of her world tour. And they seem to be pretty unbothered about who was watching. Apparently, onlooker said they were enjoying some cocktails. They even went to say thank you to the chef, which, I mean, I always find that a bit of a public-seeking spectacle if you're a celebrity. So, you know, cynicism. But since then, you know, they've been sort of not doing anything to dispel any rumours that there's something going on. Last night, Justin even actually attended one of her concerts. So I think that's a bit of cheerleading that could suggest something going on behind the scenes, or very much in front of the scenes,
yes,
let's say.
It's intriguing, isn't it? If these two didn't want us to talk about it, then they've gone the wrong way about it, haven't they? I mean, they're absolutely going for it in terms of publicity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Katie's particularly shy when it comes to publicity in any case, especially, again, I forewarned you, I'm quite cynical, but she is on her tour. It's getting okay reviews. It's a very big production. It now would seem the time that she would want to sort of keep the fires burning, so to speak. So, they're definitely not shying away from the attention.
They both need a little bit of something, don't they? He's not in office anymore, marriage over, and her pop career was going down the pan, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's had a pretty stupendous fall from grace, quite sadly, for Katy Perry. She was up there with the likes of Taylor Swift and Beyonce, Lady Gaga. Last year, her album 143 was, I think, the lowest scoring record ever on Metacritic. It failed to top 10, anything like that. And she was called boring, pop trash. The concert didn't exactly sell out. She's still on it. She's giving it a good go. But she could definitely use a bit of a sort of boost to her popularity, especially because, as you mentioned, her somewhat ill-fated Blue Origin mission to space in April, if you'll pardon the really obvious pun, but she came crashing back to Earth with a bang because of just the sort of terrible sort of negativity that sort of surrounded it.
It is astonishing that she hadn't been able to predict that she was going to get negativity. I mean, why on earth? She's obviously not unintelligent. Why on earth had she not anticipated that?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just her. She was one of six women who, I mean, listen, it is what it was. It was a glory-seeking mission to space to have fun and sort of experience zero gravity. It wasn't exactly breaking barriers for womanhood, which was sort of how it was pegged. So, I mean, she's not stupid, but neither are the others. Lauren Sanchez, Gayle King, why would any of them have done it and sort of publicly promoted themselves as sort of these massive space explorers when really they were doing an 11-minute multi-million dollars sort of glory mission. So, yeah, jury's out on that one.
It's been quite the last couple of weeks, actually, because we've also got the rumoured romance between Pamela Anderson and Liam Neeson. I mean, of the two alleged romances, which is the one that you are going to put your faith in?
Do you know, Pam and Liam sort of warm my heart a bit more. There's something quite sweet about them. They've both had some really bad luck, and obviously Liam's, you know, his misfortune is very well documented. Yeah. He was widowed, and I don't know, there's something quite sweet about them, and it seems a little bit more organic, and maybe I'll put my cynicism aside for that one. They've both got, you know, grown sons who seem to be really supporting them. They both set out on red carpet together. It's nice, and, you know, insiders have said that his late wife, Natasha Richardson's inner circle, have really supported it, so I would sort of put my money on that one. I don't know, again, maybe I'm just being a little bit unfair to Justin and Katie, but it seems to be a sort of right time, right place scenario for both of them, more so than for Pam and Liam.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. Good to talk to you. That's Charlotte Oliver, who is a features writer for The Sun.
I wish Katy Perry and Justin Trudeau all the best, Jane. I think we're being far too cynical about this. They might have a lot in common. Mm. They can talk about the vagaries of living your life in the public eye. They can talk about what they're both going to do next, because they do seem to have slightly emptier diaries than before. I think it could be a lovely thing.
Do you routinely thank the chef?
No, I don't. I don't tend to.
I can't think a chef would be in any way interested in what I made. The meal, I just chowed down. But maybe I'll try. I'm going out tomorrow night. I'll make a point of it. I'll go into the kitchen.
Katy Perry has come through some relationships as well, hasn't she? She was very briefly married to Russell Brand before lots of things were known about Russell Brand. And I think she's just come out of quite a long-term relationship with Orlando Bloom.
Oh, yes.
As well. A man who's not backwards in coming forwards. England have begun the final test against India at the Oval. They lead 2-1 in the series, which has been filled with bickering and controversy. More controversy, thank goodness. Despite record levels of warm weather this summer, today's play has been blighted by rain. Let's talk to TalkSport's Georgie Heath. Hello, Georgie.
Hello, good afternoon. How are you going?
Yes, we're going all right. There's been a lengthy rain delay, but do you expect play to restart soon? We're not too far away from the Oval here, and actually it's not raining. The clouds do seem to be parting a bit.
Yeah, I did get very wet myself as well, actually. It was very strange because the Oval was completely clear, and it was sort of odd that things started on time this morning after the squall, and then suddenly, just as it was coming up to lunch, it was literally like someone had turned a tap on a giant shower. And it just bucketed and there were ground staff running in all directions. But India, currently 72 for two. They lost Jaiswal very early to Gus Atkinson, who's obviously back in the side, playing on his home turf at Surrey. And then the end of Rahul as well to Wokes. So two wickets down for 72 at the moment. But it is the captain, Shubman Gill, who is out there again in the middle after, it's been spicy, to say the least, you would say, the last couple of weeks now, I guess, of this test match. And then obviously the blow up about what had been said between the Indian side and the curator at the Oval. And it's just, it's adding it. I hate to say it, but I love it. I love a bit of controversy.
No, we all like a bit of controversy. That argument between the groundsman and the Indian coaching team, can you just flesh that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's one of those, you sort of, he said, she said, I said, you said kind of situation. But I think the general gist is that basically, India was saying that, normally they do get to have a look at the pitch, they get to speak to ground staff, but then there was talk that there had been equipment dragged across the square. And now the square can be, that's a sort of very loose term, because if you look at the square at the Oval, there are a lot of practice pitches and it takes up half the Oval. So it's very hard to drag your bag anywhere without being on the so-called square. And, it was about, they were disrupting the pitch, that kind of thing. So it's all a lot of sort of hearsay up in the air, what was said between people. And at the moment, I think perhaps if the series hadn't already been so spicy, it probably wouldn't have really, no one would have paid too much attention to it. But I think that's what has caused it to sort of blow up. And obviously, it's a very important test match, this one. India need to win it to draw the series. England, they either need to draw or win it to win the series. So, there's a lot riding on it. And obviously, in cricket, the pitch is the most precious thing other than perhaps a body. But that gets put on the line a lot, as we've seen the likes of Ben Stokes, he's out of this game as well. The captain, so Ollie Pope, captaining another Surrey homeboy. So, yeah, it's been an exciting series, to say the least. Obviously, Shubman Gill coming in as captain recently. He's already got 400s, I think, as captain now. So he's absolutely flying, leading from the front and coming off the back of that last game. India will be feeling, they feel like they sort of riled up England a bit at the end of that, refusing to shake hands, which was very much in their rights, if you ask me. For anyone who didn't know, it was obvious that there was no chance of a result in that match. So England went to go and shake hands, and the two batters out in the middle were in the 90s, and they were like, no, they're not shaking hands yet, they want hundreds.
You mentioned
totally fair if you ask me.
Yeah, you mentioned Ben Stokes there not playing because of a shoulder injury. Do you know much about the status of that injury?
Well, I think they said it was a third grade tear of some form on his right shoulder. So he is left-handed, so that's always a good sign. But this is Ben Stokes, and I think if there was anything, if it was only a small niggle there, you wouldn't have been able to keep him off the pitch. So there is going to be a little bit of something in that. He's not going to play in the 100, I don't think. It'd be very silly if we saw him doing that or coming into any England white ball stuff, because now, obviously, the next test match focus for England is the Ashes down under, starting in November. So it's all about, let's get Ben Stokes fit and ready for that one as we can, so he can lead the team into for want of a better word, battle down under.
Yeah. India have set a new record, Georgie, losing the toss 15 times in a row. The chances of this are 1 in 32,000. So you can understand why they might feel that there's just a bit of malhumeur all round for them.
Honestly, I think I'd be looking at the coin. I'd be checking the coin. You get to that point, you think, do I just start changing what I call? I think he'd called heads every time or something. And then you think, oh, do I change it now? But I think once you've done it that many times, surely it's got to come back in your favour at some point.
Yes, well, maybe the 32,001th time.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It is. It's an exciting rest of the year for cricket. The Women's World Cup, expectations yes. are high for women's sport now, Georgie. Where would you place them?
Well, it's tricky because obviously they're in this sort of new period under Charlotte Edwards as the coach and then Nat Sivabrunt as the captain. They obviously had an incredible two series against the West Indies, which is very difficult to sort of judge on because they are quite a subpar side at the moment. There's a lot going on at West Indies cricket. So England dominated across those games and then lost the T20 and the ODI series to India, who actually played a lot better than a lot of us were expecting. So it's not going to be an easy ride for England. You know, it's not a straight we shove Charlotte Edwards in. That fixes everything because there's no way to do that, especially for a lot of the players still suffering with the bruises in the aftermath of that Ashes drubbing down under. So it's not going to be an easy World Cup, I can tell you that one. And especially in Indian conditions, it's been played in India and Sri Lanka because obviously of the tensions between India and Pakistan. So Pakistan will play their games in Sri Lanka. And then should they be in the final, that will also be in Sri Lanka. But it's going to be tricky for England. I mean, there are a lot of the players are sort of going back and playing a lot more county cricket this year because there's a new structure of that. So that's really good. And you've seen some great performances across that as well. So it's great to see, you know, they're getting so much more cricket and you can only get better if you play more cricket, sure. if you ask me.
And hopefully so that's, translates back into the squad. Georgie, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Talk Sport's Georgie Heath. You can obviously catch up with anything that does manage to happen today at the Oval on Talk Sport. We'll try and keep you abreast of things here as well. We've got plenty to entertain you in the next hour of the programme. Daisy Goodwin will be here after 30...
Never mind.
It's just worth saying.
Get a new battery, double A's, please.
Because rugby fans always make this point. The Women's Rugby World Cup is also starting 22nd of August. And the first
Well done, England, sister.
England against the USA. England are favourites for this, you know. Wouldn't it be great if we could win the Euros and the Women's Rugby World Cup? That's at the Stadium of Light in Sunderland, that. I'm sure there'll be full coverage on Talk Sport, and we'll certainly reference it here on Times Radio. Almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 now. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4. And in the next hour, President Trump's Middle East envoy is in Israel. Could there be any progress at all on a ceasefire? And this is interesting. A catastrophic decline in formal language learning in this country. More A-levels taken last year in PE than in French, German and classical languages combined. What is the impact of that going to be? Daisy Goodwin, the screenwriter, joins us after 3:30. First, let's get the latest news. Nick Ellerby.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A 76-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of administering poison at a summer camp which led to 8 children being taken to hospital. Leicestershire Police received reports of children feeling unwell at a summer camp in Statham on Monday. The suspect was arrested at the camp and is still in custody. Meanwhile, the Independent Office for Police Conduct is now investigating Leicestershire Police's response to the incident. On that, Times Radio spoke to crime and police commentator Danny Shaw.
It looks as though that's in relation to the way that these matters were handled and whether there was a failure to carry out duties and responsibilities that resulted in a delay in the police response. So it would appear that there is some concern that perhaps the police didn't respond quickly enough when complaints were made.
The Royal College of Nursing is threatening strike action over nurses' pay as they vote to reject the government's offer of a 3.6% rise. The nursing union says that's not enough to turn the tide for what they feel is an undervalued profession. 91% of nurses voted to reject the deal in a record turnout of 56%. Jane and Fee on Times Radio asked the Times health correspondent, Poppy Karonka, if there's anything the government could offer nurses to avert a strike.
They did say that there was a number of things that they were unhappy about. A huge number of vacancies in nursing, just not enough people for jobs. Another one was the actual pay scale itself and how it's set up. So nurses go on a band pay scale. It means that pay increases are quite structured, but it does mean that there's quite a low ceiling as to what you can earn. So those things might help, but I do think it's probably pay.
The Department of Health and Social Care say it's disappointing RCN members are dissatisfied after receiving two above inflation pay rises from this government. The family of a five-year-old boy is calling for an inquest after a report found health services didn't listen to their concerns in the days before his death. Yusuf Nazir from Rotherham died with sepsis in 2022 after being turned away from hospital because there were no beds. The NHS says it's changing. The family's MP Sarah Champion says that's vital.
It is a national health service. It shouldn't be better on a Tuesday than on a Thursday, for example. Where you rock up should not make a difference to the level of care that you got. We're talking about now a postcode lottery. It's luck if you turn up at the right hospital that has the right experience.
Conor McGregor has lost his attempt to overturn a jury's order that he pay more than £216,000 to a woman who accused him of rape. Court of Appeal judges rejected all grounds of his bid in the civil case. The mixed martial arts fighter denied allegations dating back to December 2018 against Nikita Hand. And more than 25,000 migrants have crossed the English Channel so far this year, a milestone hit earlier than last year. 13 boats arrived yesterday alone, carrying 898 people. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Until 4 o'clock this afternoon, John Pienaar with you as ever between 4 o'clock and seven. Now, the Prime Minister has responded to the families of Israeli hostages still held in Gaza, who condemned the UK government's plan to recognise a Palestinian state.
Those hostages need to be released immediately. They've been held for a very, very long time in absolutely intolerable conditions. So that absolutely needs to happen. The situation on the ground in Gaza needs to change. There's a humanitarian catastrophe, and that's why I've said that unless that changes materially, and obviously we'll assess that as we get to September, then we will recognise Palestine.
Meanwhile, President Trump has said it will be very hard for the US to make a trade deal with Canada after its Prime Minister Mark Carney announced plans to recognise a Palestinian state as well. Here is Mr. Carney explaining the Canadian government's decision.
Others have responsibilities, Canada included, and we make our own independent foreign policy positions. And when we see opportunities, when we see necessity, which is what we see in this case, given the retreat of the prospect of a two-state solution because of the facts on the ground, as I explained, when we see that possibility and we see the combination of an ability to influence.
Mark Carney, well, this move makes Canada the third country out of the group of G7 leading nations and economies after recent announcements by France and the UK to signal their plans to recognise a Palestinian state. Let's talk to Michael Binion, Times leader writer, former diplomatic editor of the newspaper. Michael, what do you think? Are the moves from Canada, France and indeed Britain going to make a scrap of difference to what plays out?
Well, frankly, I don't think they will, no, because Israel's not listening really to anybody except the Americans, and they certainly are not putting on the kind of pressure that would make Benjamin Netanyahu change his policies. I mean, the only reaction we've had from the Israelis is intense irritation and denunciation of what they call simply tokenism and performative statements intended to satisfy Muslim audiences back in Britain, France and Canada. And I don't think it will actually push Benjamin Netanyahu either into hastening a ceasefire in Gaza or indeed into withdrawing Israel's claim to annex the whole of the West Bank.
But if you were Sir Keir Starmer in his current set of circumstances, wouldn't you have done exactly what he has done?
Well, I think it's certainly a response and it's a gesture, and it's an important thing to make gestures, particularly at a time when public opinion in Britain is increasingly angry and upset at what seems to be a policy of starvation in Gaza, a policy of cutting off aid and cutting off vital supplies in order to cower the population. And that clearly is unacceptable and has led to these pictures that have horrified everyone of starving children. So I think the Prime Minister is right to respond to that. Now, it seems a rather odd thing to make the recognition of a Palestinian state conditional on Israel doing certain things, such as increasing aid and political rights for the Palestinians. Because if the Israelis did do that, would that mean that Starmer would then withdraw recognition?
Yes.
Well, which seems ridiculous.
This is a puzzle, and I was actually going to ask you whether you think that might indeed be the case, that they do what's required of them, and all of a sudden the UK government no longer is prepared to recognise a Palestinian state.
Well, that seems ridiculous. I mean, no. If it's a political point that you want to make, that you feel the Palestinians need to be formally included in the unity of nations, that they should be recognised as a state, possibly with a seat at the United Nations, then you go ahead and do it, whether or not the Israelis respond this way or that way. To make it a sort of instrument of leverage doesn't seem appropriate at all.
Do you buy President Trump's statement that the fact that Canada will also recognise a Palestinian state means that trade deal between the US and Canada is less likely to happen?
Well, I think that's ridiculous. They're completely unrelated to each other. I mean, a trade deal, as we know with Trump, is a sort of bargain that Trump likes to push with various countries, up, down, trying to get a deal that he thinks most favourable to America. It's not related to any other foreign policy action. And the fact that Canadians have taken this decision, if he's trying to say that that will ruin Canada's chances for getting a more satisfactory trade arrangement, then he's suggesting that Canada doesn't have the right to make its own foreign policy decisions, which, of course, will infuriate the Canadians.
Yeah, Donald Trump does say things that are ridiculous, though, doesn't he? I mean, it's not the first time he said something slightly absurd. Well, we might take issue with it, but then sometimes it appears, oddly, some might say, to work in his favour.
Well, yes, I mean, he does use leverage in all sorts of ways. And, I mean, he gets people to do things by holding out the threat of a trade sanction or of increasing tariffs or whatever it might be. And that does, yes, it does certainly alter people's behaviour sometimes, especially if they feel that the United States has the upper hand, that they really have no alternative. It doesn't seem to me the way international relations should work, but I mean, it is the cold reality of that's how things are.
We know that President Trump's Middle East envoy, his friend and business associate, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Israel. I've looked at images of him shaking hands with Netanyahu. Do you expect anything to come out of this?
Not much, frankly. I mean, the only thing that would change is if the Israelis feel that really they are losing credibility and friends and influence and everything else all around the world, but particularly in America. That's what matters, because if the Americans actually ever threaten Israel with some kind of embargo on their arms supplies, well, that would be pretty catastrophic for the Israelis. And of course, they are counting on the fact that such a strong pro-Israel sentiment in America that would never happen. But if Netanyahu flouts Trump very openly, Trump can lose patience, as he sometimes does, even with his friends, and he could turn rather nasty. So I think the Israelis will certainly listen to what Steve Witkoff is saying.
What about the Arab League and the pressure they now seem prepared to put on Hamas? This idea of states like Saudi, Egypt, Qatar demanding that Hamas disarm. Could you actually envisage that happening? And if so, how? How would that work?
Well, the Arab states actually have had no love for Hamas for a very long time. In fact, the Egyptians hate them because Hamas is linked to the Islamists in Egypt, where Sisi's government has been fighting a battle against Islamist extremism for several years. And Saudi Arabia equally has no time for Hamas. They have had the backing of Iran, which has kept them going for a long time. Well, that's pretty much gone now that Iran has had a crippling blow after the Israeli and American attacks. So Hamas is pretty friendless, and one wonders where they are still getting arms, if they are. I think that certainly the Arab states see this as a moment not only to try to curry favour with America, which would be helpful, but also to make sure that something comes out of this by getting Hamas to basically give up power.
Yeah, but this is what completely baffles me, I have to be honest. I mean, the Hamas fighters have nothing at all except their status as Hamas fighters. What on earth would persuade them to give up their weapons and do what exactly? Go where?
Well, the answer is simply go nowhere. I mean, just stay there. They're not going to move anywhere else. If they gave up their weapons, they would simply no longer be in power. And I have to say, there is an increasing number of people in Gaza who are really absolutely fed up with the situation. Well, not just fed up, I mean desperate. And if they think that Hamas is blocking the more aid coming in or blocking the stopping the Israelis halting their military action, then they'll turn on Hamas. And there are signs that some have done so. But Hamas has got a pretty tight grip so far. I mean, the problem is the situation there is so chaotic and so desperate that you never quite know who's winning in any power struggle. But certainly, I don't think Hamas can continue on more or less ignoring what everyone else around them wants them to do.
And what about suggestions that foreign forces might, if we can sort out some sort of solution, might have to get involved on the ground to stabilise the region?
Well, I think that's quite possible and quite likely. And by foreign forces, I think we probably mean forces from neighbouring Arab countries, such as Jordan or Egypt or something like that. And the Americans would be quite happy with that because both Jordan and Egypt are quite closely linked to the United States. I don't think a United Nations force is likely. They've had UN forces in Lebanon and various other places. They've never really done much. They've mostly just been targets. But Arab League armies might be there to try to keep some kind of stability and order. And, I mean, that might be some reassurance to the Israelis if and when they ever pull out their own forces. But I think at the moment it looks very unlikely that the Israelis are going to get out of Gaza anytime soon.
Do we expect, I mean, you might know much more, I'm sure you do know much more about this than I do. Are we expecting any kind of press conference from Steve Witkoff and Netanyahu? Is any announcement likely over the next couple of days?
I think a full press conference would be quite unlikely, especially I don't think Netanyahu's in a mood to actually be asked about relations with the United States. I mean, he maintains they're fine and everything's going well. It depends also how much pressure Steve Witkoff is authorised to put on the Israelis. And it may be some pressure, maybe none at all. Or it may be, a real hint that Trump would get angry if they don't comply with the latest proposals. So I don't think they really are in much of a mood to air this in public when all sorts of questions could be aired about Israel's long-term intentions.
And when we see those horrific images from Gaza and we look at the state of the place, I mean, it just seems to be at least, 70% rubble? I don't think that's an exaggeration. How will the rebuilding job happen? And how will we sort out the shattered psychological states of many of the people who are somehow still alive in there?
Well, that is a really big question, and that is what is so horrific about it. I mean, Gaza has effectively been bombed into the Stone Age. As you say, it's all rubble. People's homes are just rubble. I mean, they, amongst all the broken bits of brickwork and cement, people can find a few of their belongings, but otherwise they're having to put up tents and just cower and shelter wherever there's a space to pitch a tent. I mean, that is absolutely no way for any people to live, even in a short term. So a massive rebuilding operation is going to be needed. And the question is, who will do that and who will pay for it? And will the Israelis allow in the cement to do it? I mean, in the past, Israel has had a tight control of what can be imported into Gaza. And if they put a ban on importing cement, for example, then nothing can be done at all.
Thank you very much indeed for your time, Michael. Michael Binion, Times leader writer, former diplomatic editor of the paper.
That takes us to 16 minutes past three. Now, new statistics from the Ministry of Justice reveal that half of all prisons were rated as of concern or of serious concern, with violence and drug use a major part of the problem. Of those, almost one in five were given the worst possible ranking. Plans to tackle the crisis in our prisons include artificial intelligence technology likened to the film Minority Report. It'll identify potentially aggressive inmates before attacks happen, whilst contraband and drugs fueling the violence will also be targeted. Let's talk to Mark Fairhurst, who's the National Chairman of the Prison Officers Association. What is your reaction to these statistics about the state of our prisons? I suspect it's telling you something that you already know.
That's correct. It comes as no surprise to me. In fact, to date, there's been quite a few statistics published, including the safety and custody statistics, which highlight that once again. Assaults on staff and assaults prisoner on prisoner are at record highs. So it shows no sign of abatement. And is it any wonder that after 14 years of austerity measures and a reduction in budgets and a lack of investment in the infrastructure of our prisons, that they are creaking at the seams? And we come across yet another report which is so derogatory towards the system.
Does the early release scheme, which was aimed at alleviating some of the pressure causing some of the problems in prisons, does that appear to have had any impact, or would these statistics not include that anyway?
It did have some impact. It released the pressure when it needed to be released. But now, if you look at the weekly reports about the prison population figures, we're back up to 87,900. When the early release scheme came in, we were over 88,000. So we're slowly creeping back up. And I would imagine by September, October, if the court backlog keeps going the way it is, then we'll be back to square one again. We'll be forward, hardly any space left in the adult male estate. And that's the issue.
What's it like to work in a prison that is of concern or of serious concern?
Well, unfortunately, when you're working in a prison which has got maybe staffing issues and infrastructure which is crumbling, a lack of resource to give people a stable regime, and certainly a lack of activity spaces to keep people busy and address their offending behaviour, when you work in that prison where violence is high and staff morale is low, everything becomes normalised, and that's the problem. Nobody wants to tackle the root causes, and you just get used to it. And eventually that has a knock-on effect, because you're dealing with that many traumatic incidents that quite often you go off sick with stress and anxiety, then you get diagnosed with PTSD, and then you quickly get burnt out because your colleagues are sick and you've got to cover for them. So it's like a catch-22 position. And until we get serious about this, until we create some space so we can close wings down in Victorian jails and totally modernise them one wing at a time, which obviously is going to take a couple of years, until we do things like that and modernise the prison estate, then we're just going to hit this revolving door and things won't improve.
And is space the absolute key issue here?
Well, I think it is, yeah. That and reduction in violence and consequences for poor behaviour and having a real reset throughout the entire prison estate, until we create some space so we're not overcrowded, so we have activity spaces for everyone, so prison officers on the front line can actually do their job, which is to try and address people's offending behaviour and rehabilitate them and give them hope. Until we can do that, then we're just going to continue lurching from crisis to crisis.
This artificial intelligence, Mark Fairhurst, what do you make of it? I mean, to put it simply, I mean, it is quite a good comparison to what happens in the film Minority Report. It's going to be looking at the inmates and trying to identify, before anything happens, who is most likely to cause something to happen. Is that better than the ability of human prison officers to actually say, he looks like trouble to me?
Well, you have a gut instinct when you're an experienced prison officer and you get to know your prisoners well on your land, and that's if you don't get redeployed. You know, back in the day, we used to have our own wings, our own landings, and we knew everyone by the first name. I mean, you knew what made them tick and how to calm them down. And what really amuses me about today's announcement is we've had this artificial intelligence in play for a couple of years now. We give every prisoner who's in for violence a score, and we clock their prison record. We look at the reports on their behaviour, and then we give them a score. Are they most likely to offend, to assault staff, to assault prisoners? So we've already got that in place. And guess what? It hasn't made a bit of difference whatsoever, because violence is increasing month on month, year on year. So artificial intelligence on its own, I'm afraid, just doesn't cut it.
Almost £1 million has been announced today to try to tackle drones. What would £1 million buy on the prison estate?
Not very much, because you need several facets to combat this drone threat. And one of those facets is to introduce technology that maybe can block a drone so it returns to sender when it tries to fly over prison airspace. We need physical security like netting over exercise yards so drones can't drop their load. We need physical security like cages over windows so you can't actually open a window and collect the load because there's a cage outside. And then we definitely need additional staff resource. So we know most drone deliveries occur during the middle of the night. Would it not make more sense to put more prison officers on nights? So when we know that a drone is delivered to a cell, we have the capability to go through that door and secure the goods. So I'm afraid £900,000, it's a drop in the ocean. I don't even know where they've got that figure from, but it's not going to buy very much.
Mark Fairhurst, would you like to come on a journey back in time with us to listen to what Liz Truss suggested with regard to drones? Should we do this?
I think I know what you're going to say. It's something to do
We're going to play it. Yeah, we're going to play it. Here it comes.
But what we are doing is solutions such as installing extra netting. I was at HMP Pentonville last week. They've now got patrol dogs who are barking, which helps deter drones. So we're using all kinds of solutions to deal with contraband coming into our prison.
Right, well, I mean, the audience there in chortling at dogs that bark at drones kind of tells us how that suggestion went down in the room. How did that go down with your officers? I mean, she did mention, exactly as you've done, the problem of netting.
She did, but she never provided it when she was in government. She never got any additional funding whatsoever to provide netting. She was the one here in her government who removed dog sections from prisons because a dog could get to a throwover. That's when goods are thrown over the prison wall and prisoners collect them in the grounds. A dog's a lot quicker than a human being securing those goods and the more of a deterrent. So she was the one who removed dog sections from prisons. So she never provided any funding. And let's be honest, a dog barking at a drone, when you're dealing with organised criminal gangs, it's not much of a deterrent, is it? Let's be honest. And when a lettuce lasts longer than air in government in a position of prime minister, then that tells you all you need to know about this.
Yeah, we kind of gifted everybody that one. The Labour MP Emily Thornberry is calling for Pentonville, mentioned there by Liz Truss, to actually just be shut down. She says it's got a problem with cockroaches. Inmates are kept in cells for 22 hours a day. More than 100 were illegally held past their release date. Does she have a point that actually some of our prisons just have to go? They can't be repaired. They can't have annexes and additions made to them. We just need to start again somewhere.
Yeah, it really depresses me when people like Emily, who are good people, come out with the same trope that everybody else has. Let's close this prison down because it's not doing so well. It's not doing so well because the infrastructure is crumbling because we haven't had the investment over time to do the repairs. Now, Liverpool Prison, my own prison, was in a similar situation in 2017, and everybody was calling for Liverpool to be closed. You know what we did with Liverpool? We closed a wing at a time, so we reduced the prison population by 40% because I had the capacity to do that at the time. And we closed the wing down at a time, and we are totally modernised in that jail. It's a totally different jail. There's absolutely nothing wrong with Victorian prisons as long as you maintain them, and that's what we need to do. We need to create space for the likes of Pentonville. Let's close a wing down at a time, and Wandsworth, no different, that needs the same. And let's totally modernise our Victorian prisons because they are really good prisons and they serve our communities well.
Good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed. That's Mark Fairhurst, who is the National Chairman of the Prison Officers Association.
And apropos of nothing, really, the ONS has released Britain's most popular baby names from 2024.
Oh, I always love these.
And it's always interesting, isn't it?
I'm going to think that Olivia is still there at the
She's
top.
Unbelievably clinging on in the girls' names, number one. Mohammed, because it can be spelled in any number of different ways, is still number one for boys. But I do love the fact that because of this so-called 100-year rule, some of those great-grandparents and grandparents' names are creeping in. And there's just something adorable about the fact that Elsie is now in the top 10 baby girls' names. So if there are any baby Elsies out there this afternoon, welcome. And I hope you're being well cared for and you're enjoying being kept up to date with everything going on in the world.
What is let's just do randomly, the seventh most popular girl and boy?
Well, I haven't got that in front of me at the moment.
Oh, I thought you just had the whole thing.
I know we've got another guest. I just wanted to tell Fia.
We'll get there.
We're enjoying ourselves, Hugo. We're not
all right, Hugo.
He's
on the list.
They start interrupting. Mm. No, Hugo's nowhere there. Some of the interesting names that are not so popular, but just worth noting. Some little girls this year have been called Everest, after the well-known double glazing firm.
Fit the best. Everest.
Poem.
Okay. Poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Orchid.
Not bad.
And Sicily, and that's the island
Okay, not yeah. Cecily,
and,
Sicily.
No, Sicily. And how about this for boys? Cuthbert. I mean, I'm sorry. Crispin.
Dibble and Drub. Yeah.
Crispin. Beckham.
Okay.
And Awesome.
Awesome, not Orson. Awesome.
Awesome. I mean, the problem with that is, what if Awesome turns out to be just bang average? And why not? What's wrong with that? Anyway, let's hope there's some baby Serenas and Chloes out there by this time next year.
Ryan has given me the number sevens. They are Luca and Freya.
Thank you very much.
Those
Ryan's
beautiful
on it.
Names. Yep. Yeah. I love Awesome. You're absolutely right. Maybe next year they'll just be Kraken. Kraken Garvey.
Learning a language is not as popular as it used to be. Very few, relatively speaking, A-level students do a modern language these days. They seem to prefer doing subjects like PE. Laura McInnery is the co-founder of Teacher Tap and a former editor of Schools Week. So what's happening here, Laura?
So we've had a decline in modern foreign languages for a long time in schools. I mean, the Labour Party were dealing with this back in the 90s. Their solution at the time was to stop young people doing it mandatory. It wasn't mandatory anymore after the age of 14, but then you had to do it from the age of 7.
Right.
But ever since then, we've not really got on top of it. The Conservatives tried to make it so that more schools would have young people do languages up to 16, but frankly, it just keeps dropping and dropping.
Yes, and I suppose you could say, well, we've got all the technology these days, you don't need it, you've got your Google Translate and everything else. But actually, there's probably a really serious side to this. Just, I mean, tell me, are you concerned about it?
One of the reasons it matters is, for example, being able to send people to have diplomatic conversations, to do business trade, to actually take part in things like intelligence can really matter. And so there is not just the sense of knowing languages because it's a good thing when you go on holiday, but we do want people who are capable linguists, which can go beyond some of the stuff that you'll learn on technology. And I think that is why there is always a concern about it. And the fact that we don't look very good internationally when you've got other countries where their entire degrees are in multiple different languages, and we don't have that. So it's not a major concern in schools on the ground, but I can understand why, as a country, it just isn't good if we don't have more people doing languages.
Are schools just not able to offer the useful languages? I mean, how many children learn Mandarin? What about Arabic? What about Russian?
This is one of the strange things about England, is that most other countries will teach children the first language of the country and then the second language. Here in England, we have this strange concept of modern foreign languages, which is that essentially you can teach children any language and we allow you to teach the classic languages as well. Now, that means that A, there aren't lots of language teachers all in one subject. So you can end up doing, say, Spanish at primary school, and then at 11, when you change to secondary school, you suddenly find yourself doing French. B, if we did shift suddenly to having a lot more people doing languages, we just don't have the language teachers because we've not spent generations getting everybody up to speed in one language. Mm. And also, children generally don't have as access to the languages in the way that other people do English. So if you're in another country, you're probably going to hear some pop music in English, you're going to watch some TV, some films in English. That isn't something that children here in England have, so they're less confident with the language as well.
Thank you very much indeed. I think it is quite worrying, this. Laura McInnery, co-founder of Teacher Tap, former editor of Schools Week. And I say that as someone who really struggled to learn a foreign language, but I'm hugely admiring of those people who do learn them.
Well, it's never too late. You can pick it up later in life. No, it's never too late. I think every Wednesday evening you should commit to a nice little evening class and polish up some German for us.
OK, well, I do have an O-level in German.
There you go. You're off to a flying start. Coming up, our big interview today is with the screenwriter Daisy Goodwin. We'll also get a sneak peek into the Times Saturday magazine, which will include a discussion about middle-class, middle-aged women having substantial body tattoos. It's very vulgar. First, we'll get a check on the latest news headlines with Nick Ellerby.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. A police cordon remains in place around a summer camp in Leicestershire where 8 children are suspected to have been poisoned. A 76-year-old man has been arrested. Times Radio spoke to crime and police commentator Danny Shaw after Leicestershire police were contacted about children feeling unwell at the camp in Staffan on Sunday.
The report, they say, was made by a third party. They then sent officers along with paramedics, ambulance staff to safeguard the children. Following an initial assessment, the police said 8 children were taken to hospital as a precaution. The good news is that all have since been discharged.
The suspect is still in custody. Nurses in England could soon vote on whether or not to strike after rejecting a pay deal from the government of 3.6%. The Department of Health says they've been offered two increases above inflation. The Shadow Home Secretary has described migrant channel crossings as a national emergency. Chris Philp's comments come as almost 900 people arrived on small boats into the UK yesterday, taking the yearly total to more than 25,000. Mixed martial arts fighter Conor McGregor has failed in his bid to overturn a civil jury finding that he sexually assaulted a woman. Nikita Hand was awarded £216,000 in damages and costs last November. And heavy and thundery showers are battering southern parts of England. A yellow warning's in place until 9 o'clock this evening, covering areas including Bristol, Oxford, Southampton, London, Kent and Ipswich. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. It's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m. Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Jane Mulkerins will be here to lower the tone at around about a quarter to four this afternoon as we look ahead to some of the delights in the Times magazine across the weekend. Let's talk now, though, to the screenwriter, playwright Daisy Goodwin. Hello, Daisy. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, Jane.
How are you?
I'm good.
Great.
I'm good. I'm very good indeed.
All right, we've established that. You're on good form, Daisy. It's only because I can't see you. I don't know for why I can't see you. Oh, apparently you're behind me. That doesn't help me. I'm staring behind you. I'm staring in the other direction. I bet you look fabulous. Okay. I'll treat myself later.
So good.
Right. Now, you're here to talk about your play, By Royal Appointment, and it's currently running. Mm-hmm. Where is it at the moment? I think it's been in London.
It's
where is it now?
Guildford. It was in Richmond. It's now in Guildford.
Yep.
And it'll be there till Saturday, and then it moves to the Lowry Theatre in Salford, Manchester.
And you have a starry cast.
6th to the 9th.
Yeah.
Yes, we've got Anne Reid, who at 90 years old is doing 7 or is it 8 shows a week. I mean, that's pretty astonishing.
Wow.
It's the most incredible performance too. I mean, really worth going to see just for that. She's amazing. And the equally incredible but slightly younger Caroline Quentin playing the Queen's dresser. Angela Kelly, well, it's not Angela Kelly, but it's sort of loosely based on Angela Kelly. Mm. And then we've got the designer, played by James Wilby, and the milliner, played by James Dreyfuss.
I mean, that's a phenomenal quartet of powerhouses you've got there. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I've never written a play before, so it's all very exciting.
Right. Now, you say we need to be very careful about this then. The character that is loosely based on Angela Kelly is not necessarily Angela Kelly. You do say, I know that you haven't met Angela Kelly, and Angela Kelly would be an interview I'd love to do. I'm sure you'd love to do it as well.
Well, I can say that Angela Kelly has seen the play.
Yes.
And loves it.
Excellent. Right. Well, what we need to establish here is that By Royal Appointment is about the late Queen Elizabeth II and her outfits and how she sometimes conveyed messages, quite subtle ones, through what she was wearing, and also the incredible and increasing influence as the late Queen became slightly more frail of a dresser who most of us believe almost certainly to be based on the real life person of Angela Kelly.
I don't think we need to be too mealy-mouthed about it, because Angela has seen the show and is very
she's happy with it.
Okay. I mean, it's not, she really is happy with it.
You've established that.
So I tell you what, ladies,
we're worried about legal action.
Just as a listener here, for a play that's not actually about Angela Kelly,
it's about
mentions for her.
Well, anyway, so the play is basically about the secret power of the Queen, which, you know, the most discreet woman in the world, to say what she really thought, which is through her clothes. And
as an individual in her real life, she wasn't that interested in clothes per se, was she?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, she was really very happy just wearing a barber and a headscarf. But, you know, wearing outfits was part of the job, costumes as part of the job. And she, in some ways, was, you know, a leading lady, and she had to dress for whatever occasion it was. And so I've chosen sort of, I think, about 12 moments in her reign where, you know, the clothes mean something. It starts with the investiture of the Prince of Wales in 1969, which is the first time that the world saw the Queen's knees.
Yes, and, I mean, this was significant. I had a look at that image of what she was wearing that day a little bit earlier. And yes, the dress she's wearing is actually, well, it's relatively short, isn't it?
It is, yes. And it was all to do with her kind of wanting, you know, like as the investiture was, it was showing, you know, this is the monarchy. We go back to, you know, before the Norman Conquest, but we're also looking forward. And, you know, here's Prince Charles wearing, knee breeches and silk stockings. And here am I wearing a miniskirt. And, you know, I can move with the times. Because there'd been a lot of stuff around there saying the Queen was sort of out of touch and this, that and the other. And so by raising her hemline, she was showing that she was, as, you know, as she says in the play, am I with it? And that was the notion there. It was sensational at the time.
Yes.
I mean, it caused a sensation. And then she has this hilarious hat.
Well, I was going to mention that. It's sort of visions of Star Trek there. Can you describe it?
Well, it looks like a space helmet, as you say, with a sort of gold sequin top. And it's a sort of cross between a Tudor headdress and a space helmet. That's exactly what it is, with a lot of gold sequins and yellow silk. And it's possibly one of the more ludicrous bits of headgear you've ever seen. But it had a sort of, it did, as you say, had a sort of certain Star Trek vibe. Mm. And I think, again, that was deliberate. I mean, the point about the Queen's clothes is that nothing is left to chance. No detail is not scrutinised. And, you know, there was whole layers of meaning behind that outfit.
Let's go a few decades into the future from the investiture. I never knew how to say that. And the Queen goes to Ireland. Now, this was a hugely significant visit, wasn't it? Tell me about what she wore then.
Well, it was a hugely significant because the first time that a British monarch, had been to Ireland for a century or so, I think. And, you know, it was the culmination of a huge, you know, histories of centuries of bitterness between the two countries. And of course, you know, the Queen's uncle, great uncle, had been blown up by Mountbatten, had been blown up by the IRA. So there were personal scores for her as well as everything else. And she absolutely plays a blinder, and she wears emerald green, you know, the most shamrocky colour you can imagine, and she's got a bloody great shamrock diamond brooch, and it's basically saying, I'm here, I'm on your side, I've come here to put the past behind us. And
and there was also the time when she had, I think there were rumours that she'd made a vaguely pro-Brexity comment in private, and then she did what?
Oh, this is hilarious. So there was a Yes, there were rumours put about, I think, by Michael Gove that she'd been pro-Brexit. And, you know, what we know of the Queen, she was the most discreet person in the world, and she certainly would have said nothing like that to the likes of Michael Gove. So at the state opening of Parliament in 2016, she wears a blue hat that has yellow, that has 12 yellow rosettes on it, which are, as you know, of course, the colours of the European flag. And that, I think, was a very significant statement, because she wasn't saying I'm pro the European Union. What she was saying is that, you know, you can either believe the people who pretend to know my innermost thoughts,
yeah,
or you can see what I'm doing here, but neither of you will never know what I really think.
And in your play, does Anne Reed wear all these incredible outfits?
No, but you see them. Because when I wrote the play, because I've never written a play before, I had her changing clothes 25 times. And it had to be pointed out to me that that's actually not possible, that, you know, there is no such thing as a quick clothes change. And so we had to kind of think again, but we thought again. And so you see the clothes, but not necessarily on her, although there are occasions where she wears some of them. Yeah. And we've made beautiful replicas of them.
We're just going to have to interrupt you just for a second, because there's a police press conference. It's in Leicestershire, isn't it?
It is in Leicestershire, and we will join it now. We'll let you know who's talking in a minute.
There's a 76-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of administering poison or a noxious substance. He remains in custody at this time. The investigation is now being led by the East Midlands Specialist Operations Unit's major investigation team. And this will allow a full and thorough investigation to take place with dedicated resources. Detectives and uniformed officers remain in the area, carrying out further inquiries and to establish the full circumstances of the incident, as well as providing reassurance to the families and the local community. This is a complex and sensitive investigation, and we do understand the concern that it will have caused. Please be reassured that we have dedicated resources deployed and continue to work with a number of partner agencies as part of our response. We will provide further updates as and when we're able to do so. And I'd like to remind people that a dedicated major incident public portal has been created. Details of this can be found on our website. Thank you, and I will take a few questions.
So you're listening there to James Avery speaking on behalf of Leicestershire Police, and this is to do with a 76-year-old man who has been arrested following eight children becoming ill at a summer camp in Leicestershire. The man has been detained on suspicion of administering poison or a noxious thing. And as you heard there from the police, there is a public portal available for people who need more information, and we will be covering this throughout the rest of the afternoon on Times Radio.
And it's 4:15. You're listening to Times Radio, and we're in conversation with Daisy Goodwin. She has written a play called By Royal Appointment. It's just about to go to Salford, to the Lowry Theatre there. It's about the late Queen and the messages she conveyed through her incredible clothes. One thing, Daisy, that I do remember about as a young journalist and reporter, actually going on royal visits and seeing the Queen opening a cider factory in Hereford, that kind of thing, she had to be conspicuous. And so she actually specialised in incredibly bright colours that actually most of us wouldn't go near, but she understood it was part of her job.
Totally. I mean, and I think that's where, you know, Queen fashion, royal fashion is a very particular thing, but she, you know, she wore these incredible, as you say, acid yellow, fuchsia, orange, all these colours that, yes, most of us wouldn't wear, because the point is she wanted people to see her and know she was there, because there's no point coming out to see the Queen if you can't tell which one she is. You know, she's a little old lady, you know, she needs to be so bright that you can't miss her. And there were sort of reasons she wore particular colours, like, you know, when she goes to China, she wears red because that's, you know, an auspicious colour in China. For her Silver Jubilee, she wore pink because that's what she'd worn to her grandfather's Silver Jubilee. And, you know, there was a whole rumour about how she wore blue to the weddings of her three eldest children and then didn't wear blue to Prince Edward's wedding because everyone said that blue had brought them all.
Right, and he's still happily married, so there you go, it worked.
Amazing, there you go.
And just very briefly, her clothes on the whole were designed by men for a very long time. I mean, some really notable couturiers, like the likes of Norman Hartnell. Oh dear, I think have we lost it?
Sorry, I'm back.
You're back. Yeah,
I lost you for a second. Yeah,
tell us who designed these incredible clothes that the Queen was wearing.
Well, there was Norman Hartnell to begin with, who worked for her mother, and he was very feminine. Then Hardy Amis comes into play, and he's more tailored. He's all about the line, and then finally, the person that takes over is in fact Angela Kelly, who designs the outfits from. Basically in this century. And what's interesting about her is that I think she is approaching the Queen's clothes from the basis of designing for the Queen as a woman, not just as a Queen. And I think she did a remarkably good job.
But we have to acknowledge that Angela Kelly got exceptionally close to the Queen, the late Queen,
yes.
Particularly in the last couple of years of her life. And I think she'd been led to expect that she'd be allowed to stay on the royal estate in a property there. And that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. I mean, again, I haven't spoken to Angela about that, so I don't know the true details, but I do know that I do think that she thought she might be allowed to stay on. But it is a classic thing that if you're the Queen, you know, the favourite, when a new regime comes in, you go from being the most important person in court to nothing. And that was the thing that made me think there's a drama in this. That, you know, you can have all this, you have the ear of the Queen, you can be absolutely at her side 24/7, and then, you know, she dies and you're out in your ear.
Daisy, thank you very much. I think it's a really, really interesting idea for the play, which is called By Royal Appointment, and you can see it in Salford in a couple of days' time. Currently in Guildford. Currently in Guildford, then it's going to Salford.
Lovely. Travelling around the country. Jane Moore-Kerins will be with us to talk us through the very best of the Saturday Times magazine in a couple of moments' time, 12 minutes to four. Jane and Fee here on Times Radio. Oh, and we just crack on, don't we?
Yeah, we just crack on.
Sorry. I've become so pre-programmed. So I go, when I'm in the kitchen at home, I wait for the hard quarterways and quarter to the hour.
Yes. Yeah, do you announce the time? I do, before you stop.
I still read the news headlines every 15 minutes.
Chasing your courgette. Excellent. Good.
Right. So you're here, Jane.
I'm here.
poor Ryan. It's kind of like, what do you expect
to
me to do?
But I do like the way that neither Jane or I jumped in to help you there, even though we both knew. There was no us. Just left
well,
you.
That's absolutely typical of one, Jane. I didn't expect it from you. Right. So let's talk about what's in the Saturday magazine. Do you know what? I was really intrigued, Jane. I know it's not the front cover piece, but the piece written by Victoria Richards about the tattoo taboo.
Yeah.
Because she is 44 years old. She's got 30 tattoos. She describes herself as private school educated, highly qualified mother of two who is sick of being side-eyed at the school gate and sized up on the tube. And there's a little bit in the magazine. I'll quote, this is her telling her own story. Only sailors and prostitutes get tattoos. That's what my mum said in horror as I strolled into the kitchen with my first tattoo at the age of 17. And that could be my mum as well. Mm. I think you are just in two camps on tattoos. You hate them or you love them.
Well, I think my mum said exactly the same thing when I got my nose pierced when I was 17. People look at you and make assumptions.
Looking at your nose.
No, I don't have it anymore. Oh. It was mainly to annoy my French teacher and my parents, and it did both successfully. But I've got one little tattoo here on my wrist, it was months of my dad being unhappy with that. It's just a tiny little lightning bolt.
Yeah, it's very pretty. I mean, I've got one on my ankle. I've got a tiny tattoo on my ankle, which I had done when I was 23. I'm 56.
Yeah. I mean, I was 42.
But yeah.
But yeah, Victoria Richards' piece is really interesting. So she's 44. She's, you know, she is a mother who gets side-eyed at the school gates. She says she's noticed editors' eyes flicking down her arms in job interviews because hers are more than like a little one on her ankle or her wrist. You know, she's got kind of, you know, ones on her arms and her legs, which lots and lots of women do now, I think. And she says, you know, the reaction from parents and older relatives and from bosses is often a feedback loop that begins with outright disapproval, then warms up to begrudging curiosity. She's got 30 tattoos on her fingers, wrists, arms, legs, feet, stomach and ribs. I do think it's really interesting because I think even though they are so widespread now, I agree with you, Fee. I think people fall into two camps, which is the either it's absolutely, you know, just really doesn't bother you, you know, your body, your choice. Or people think you're saying something, you're making a statement. And I don't think, I mean, for Victoria, she says she isn't making a statement with them. She's just, she wanted to reclaim her body for herself. You know, she said that, you know, that she feels that women are often indoctrinated, that bodies are performative, that skin is for other people, for men, for fashion, for Botox, for fillers, for Instagram. And it's her way of rebelling, you know, in making it for herself. Yeah. What do you think, Jane Garvey?
I'm just mulling that over, and I hadn't heard that argument before. Mm. And yeah, good luck to her.
I wonder whether or not there will be a kind of pendulum swing towards bare, uninked skin in the generation under the current generation.
Well, it is interesting. I think it is more unusual now not to have one amongst, I would say, probably the under 40s. It's probably more unusual not to have a tattoo than to have one. So, yeah, perhaps you're right. Mm. Is the way of rebelling will be to stay away from the needle. Can we talk briefly about Charlie Kirk?
Yes, we should talk in long form about Charlie Kirk. I mean, it's a really, really fascinating interview, especially for people who might never have come across him before. I mean, he is hugely influential in his world, though. Not in everybody else's. No. I suspect not in every Times Radio listener.
No, not necessarily for a lot of people in our country. I mean, he is probably one of the most terrifying prophets of the future that we've had on the cover of the magazine, and we've had a few, particularly recently. So he's 31, Charlie Kirk. He's a grassroots activist in America, and he's basically the person Trump credits with bringing him the youth vote, which, you know, Trump did, I think, the second largest swing towards Trump after Hispanics was young people. And he credits Kirk with a huge amount of this. He runs an organization called Turning Point, which he spent the last decade touring college campuses in America and basically kind of whipping up the right of center youth vote. So Katie Balls, the hardest working woman in Washington, our Washington editor, went to Florida for the Student Action Summit, which is run by Charlie Kirk, and it wasn't exactly Paris in 68, let's say that. Russell Brand was there speaking.
Being really celebrated as well.
Being so celebrated. The students, the things they wear at these things, American Lives Matter t-shirts, MAGA caps saying finish the wall and make elections fair again. Where I think the reactions from some of the girls that Katie talks to are probably the scariest for me. They're all, you know, incredibly pro-life. They're not just dressing like trad wives, but the attitudes of sort of expecting and wanting men to support them and not go out to work. It's terrifying. And this is a sizable.
Do you know what, Jane? They're young.
Yeah.
Things might change. You never know.
Thanks
it's a
for
really,
the optimism.
It's a really, really interesting piece, though. And I urge people to read it because, you know, if he's not in your orbit, one day he will be. Yeah. And certainly his influence will be too. Just to absolutely hand it to Alex James as well. So the former Blur, he was bassist, wasn't he? Guitarist, bassist. So he now runs this huge farm, doesn't he, somewhere in the Cotswolds. And he's got some really cracking recipes for cheese. And just, I think, in the week that Wembley's being taken over by Oasis, it's just nice to see someone doing something with a bit of pizza dough and some mozzarella.
And I would just like to hand it to Times Magazine subs as well, that the headline on the recipe section is Sorted for Cheese and Fizz.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't necessarily by Blur, but, you know, it's a 90s reference. But yeah, there's lots of lovely recipes featuring Alex James's cheeses and pictures of Alex James with a bear shin, if that tickles your fancy.
He looks very happy with his wheels of cheese. Jane Mulcairns, thank you very much indeed. Am I going to get this part of the programme right? I hope so. 5 minutes to four, something going to happen?
Jeff Norcott on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. Every Friday night from 7, Jeff Norcott takes you on an adventure through the latest global news, politics, philosophy, entertainment and the arts. Exploring the stories beyond the headlines and taking a light-hearted look at all the weekend's cultural highlights at home and abroad.
All that and more on Friday Night with Norcott.
Every Friday night from 7 on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. What's not to love? Start your journey at visitdubai.com.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
You've reached the final level. The Spicy McNuggets side mission. Maximum flavour, crispy crunch, and a spicy dip with a kick.
Are you ready?
Spicy McNuggets, for a limited time only.
Until the 9th of September 25. Fees apply to delivery. Participation and price may vary. Subject to availability. Serving times apply.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
What time is it?
8 a.m. and I've already meditated, stretched and been for a big run.
How?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8 Classic. It's got sleep tracking and bedtime guidance to remind me when to go to bed, so I always wake up early and fresh.
And you made me coffee.
That's mine.
Oh.
Buy the new Galaxy Watch 8 Classic today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app. Intended for general wellness and fitness purposes only.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thanks to Jill, who says she has seen Daisy Goodwin's play by royal appointment during its run in Bath, and she said it was great. I rated it highly. I was actually surprised to find myself feeling rather emotional, remembering some of the events portrayed via the Queen's outfits, which were absolutely stunning. I want to say congratulations to Daisy Goodwin. Well, thank you, Jill, for telling us how much you enjoyed it. Lots of people, they just don't like tattoos. People feel very strongly about tattoos.
Yeah, they do. They really do. Yeah.
I have to say, I'm pretty ambivalent. If someone wants to have one, what I'd say, good luck to them.
Yes, I think you and I are definitely of a generation where the people who had tattoos were probably quite different to us, whereas I think for the generation underneath us, there is no kind of barrier at all. I'm pretty sure that I would have been expelled from my school if I'd had a tattoo.
Oh,
it's kind of that level.
Yes. Oh, I would have been expelled. Yes.
Yeah. But that wouldn't happen now. So things are just massively, massively changed. Although you shouldn't have a tattoo if you're under 18.
No. Well, so everything's
so sixth form
there.
College, not school.
Right. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for listening. And we should say that we're very grateful to recent joiners, aren't we, to Times Radio, who are boosting the listening figures very nicely. Thank you very much for that. I mean, I think it's because we're so slick.
Very much so. And gosh, I've demonstrated that today.
It's
a very, very highly crafted show, and I've made absolutely no mess ups at all. So thank you for bearing with us. Thank God a professional has entered the room. John Pienaar will take over from us at 4 o'clock. Our producer today, Hugo Chambray, our technical operator and researcher Ryan Boyden. Thank you for listening. Enjoy your weekend when you get to it.
I'm going to work on the idea of having a new baby called Awesome. I think that's what I'll try and focus on over the next couple of days.
Fun times at Garvey household.
Back on Monday. Goodbye.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee and Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A man in his 70s has been arrested on suspicion of giving poison to children at a summer camp in Leicestershire. And the Royal College of Nursing is threatening strike action after voting to reject the government's offer of a 3.6% pay rise. And coming up on the show, as Washington sanctions the Palestinian Authority for undermining peace, where does that leave global efforts to push for a two-state solution in the Middle East? I'll be talking to a world affairs expert, and we'll be getting the perspective from Israel. And who killed Blondie the Lion? I'll be talking to the actor and campaigner against trophy hunter Peter Egan after a reserved lion that was being studied by British academics was allegedly lured away and killed for sport.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Nick Ellaby.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A 76-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of administering poison at a summer camp which led to 8 children being taken to hospital. Leicestershire Police received reports of children feeling unwell at a summer camp in Statham on Sunday. The suspect was arrested at the camp and is still in custody. All 8 children have now been discharged from hospital. Leicestershire Police Assistant Chief Constable James Avery gave this statement.
The investigation is now being led by the East Midlands Specialist Operations Unit's Major Investigation Team. And this will allow a full and thorough investigation to take place with dedicated resources. Detectives and uniformed officers remain in the area carrying out further inquiries and to establish the full circumstances of the incident.
Meanwhile, the Independent Office for Police Conduct is now investigating Leicestershire Police's delayed response to the incident. The Royal College of Nursing is threatening strike action over nurses' pay as they vote to reject the government's offer of a 3.6% rise. The nursing union say they feel undervalued. 91% of nurses voted to reject the deal in a record turnout of 56%. The Department of Health and Social Care says it's disappointing RCN members are dissatisfied after receiving 2 above-inflation pay rises from this government. Jane and Fee on Times Radio asked the Times health correspondent Poppy Karonka if the public could turn against striking nurses, as we've seen with doctors.
The backlash to the junior doctors striking was a lot to do with the fact that they got quite a large pay rise the year before. Nurses haven't really had that ever, and I think it's quite a sympathetic case. But if it does come to be, and, you know, the conditions and the parameters of that strike, it might mean that the public does turn against them. It's sort of hard to see that happening with nurses as a profession, I think.
Conor McGregor has lost his appeal on all 5 grounds in a civil sexual assault case. The mixed martial arts fighter withdrew what his team called new evidence at the last minute at a hearing earlier this month. 35-year-old Nikita Hand sued him, having accused him of rape in Dublin in December 2018 and was awarded £216,000. She's made an emotional statement outside Ireland's High Court.
This appeal has re-traumatised me over and over again. Being forced to relive it, what happened has had a huge impact on me. To every survivor out there, I know how hard it is, but please, don't be silenced. You deserve to be heard. You also deserve justice.
And the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Phillips, described migrant channel crossings as a national emergency. It's after more than 25,000 migrants have crossed the English Channel so far this year, a milestone hit earlier than last year. 13 boats arrived yesterday alone, carrying 898 people. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pina on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, I'm John Pina with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, the diplomatic and political battle over Gaza and the creation of a state of Palestine has just escalated. We wondered which way the biggest player in the game, President Trump, was going to jump. Well, now we know. He's dug in hard on the side of Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's hardliners. After threatening trade tariffs against Canada for backing Palestinian statehood, the Trump administration has just effectively turned its back on the Palestinian Authority, which is seen by European and Arab leaders as a vital part, after new elections, of any future Palestinian state. Now, earlier this afternoon, then, the U.S. State Department announced visa sanctions against those Palestinians. In the eyes of Washington, the only remaining Palestinian administration was out in the cold. Now, if Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron of France and now the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney had hoped that President Trump would leave them to pursue the goal of an independent Palestine unimpeded, well, they got that wrong. So where does that all leave the multinational push to move towards recognition of Palestine and ceasefire in Gaza and relief for Gaza? And what about the hostages? Now, clearly, of course, this does seem, doesn't it, remote, even academic, on the ground in Gaza with the killing and the suffering going on there now. Is it just an academic argument then? But maybe no, maybe it's more than that, because the major powers of the world are moving around a question which is crucial to any long-term consideration for the future of Palestine, the Palestinian territory, and the Middle East, if they have such a future. I'll have all the latest and the best and the most up-to-date analysis for you on the programme. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, I want to welcome the foreign affairs analyst and author, Tim Marshall. Tim, welcome back to the programme.
Greetings, John.
I made the point, always good to have you, Tim. I made the point that diplomatic manoeuvring, it does maybe seem rather remote from the real-world crisis that's going on in Gaza. And Palestinian statehood, Tim, is maybe more about symbolism than change on the ground. But we are seeing these plates moving. And in looking into the future for this territory, these questions are important. So what are your thoughts on the way that President Trump has followed up his aggressive rejection of Palestinian statehood with his threats to Canada and now announced the sanctioning of the Palestinian Authority?
I think he's just pretty much undercut a lot of the movements that have happened this week. There was one in particular which was got a very muted coverage, but in fact was much more significant than the British government's saying it will recognise Palestine, possibly, in September. And that was the Arab League saying at the UN this week, along with a lot of other countries, A, it condemned Hamas for October 7th, B, it said it must disarm, and then C, it talked about the process towards two states in which Hamas disarms and hands its weapons to the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority then comes in and governs Gaza. And Egypt, even as we speak, is training hundreds of PA police officers to prepare them for such an event. And yet, suddenly, in come the State Department, and they will have run this past the White House, you can be sure of that, saying, well, actually, no, we think we're going to sanction many members and officers in the PA, the very body that is now supposed to be one day taking over the state of Palestine. So, yeah, I think they've tried to cut them out from underneath their feet.
Okay, and I guess